this show is not for the easily offended. So if you are easily offended, go listen to something else.
Welcome back, Indie Comic Book Noise listeners. We're back. You know, you couldn't keep us away. We love our indie comics. And who are we? We are Andrew the LA Rabbit and Super Steve from the Bunker.
And Kevin.
Wait, you're not going to introduce me? How long has it been?
Well, I was, building the dramatic tension up. Oh. Yes, we are Phil-less tonight. But Phil will be back. He's doing very important work. The Ottawa Otter has many responsibilities to the citizens of Canada.
I thought he was mad at us.
Oh. See, I had this great joke. If you know, you weren't going to show up, it's going to be like, well, Andrew's off in Disneyland, and Steve's busy raking.
But Phil, there's nothing, there's no excuse.
I guess not.
There's no reasonable explanation. We'll find out next time.
I don't know. Maybe he's distraught that Double Take shut down.
Or he's the cause. His review.
Oh,
he might be their only sale, so.
Well, yeah, weren't they giving, like, I thought New York Comic Con, they were just giving away all their stuff.
And rightly so. You can listen to Indie Comic Book Noise on iTunes or over on IndieComicBookNoise.com and find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Indie Comic Book N. You can also listen to us over on our sister show, It's Marvel Noise, where we talk about all of our Marvel zombieism.
Movies, all the Marvel properties, like we do with all the indie, except, you know, there's not as many cool movies. And video games.
Are we going to be talking about that European one? The trailer came out today. What was that? That Valerian? Or how do you pronounce that? You know, the good Euro sci-fi stuff.
Yeah, that's a pretty small category. But this show is not for the easily offended, as our intro says. Which just means that sometimes we use some harsh language. I really doubt anyone has ever genuinely been offended by anything we say,
or if they have, they've stopped listening by now.
Yes, I mean, maybe they're offended that we didn't read their book, but that's just because we haven't gotten to it yet. But I have been busy, gentlemen. Halloween is a busy time here in Los Angeles because what at one time was called Stan Lee's Kamikaze is now Stan Lee's Los Angeles Comic Con.
Oh, I thought it was Alley Rabbit Con.
I thought they were renaming L.A. Stan Lee's L.A.
Oh, jeez.
That would be appropriate. It was weird. They just did this branding like the week before, it felt like. Suddenly, we're calling it something different. I have no idea why the change. It seemed inopportunely timed. But the conspiracy theories, I think, hold that they wanted to secure a Los Angeles Comic-Con before the San Diego people could move here. Because, as you may recall, they had WonderCon in L.A. For 1 year.
Yeah, I thought it might be they didn't want to be associated with kamikazes, but, you know.
Yeah, I don't. It seemed to be fine, but the show has had some changes. You may remember Elvira was a big part of the show, and she is no longer associated with the show. Likewise, they used to have the Stan Lee Museum, which was a huge section. I talked a little bit about on Marvel Noise, so let's get off the Stan Lee point. But it's a smaller show now. Only one hall, but still pretty packed. And the thing I like about the show that's a bit of a drawback for me, but I think is advantageous to the show, is it really is a little bit of everything. There's a strong cosplay element. There are comics there. Don't get me wrong. I mean, there's plenty of books, but there's also a lot of crafty stuff. You know, not just your prints, but like clothing and flasks and purses and all the kind of pop culture accoutrement.
Yeah.
Plus go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of stuff like that within the last year where you have like all your Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. symbols and all that like put onto a flask, which is kind of neat. Or that you have your like Legend of Zelda rugs that someone custom made and sewed themselves. It's like for $100. And I'm like, well, that's kind of cool, but not something I would personally buy.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. There isn't a lot of this. I don't really... I like that stuff, but it's not like I want to live in a place where everything's... You know, I'm not going to have every element of the house designed with that theming in it. But I like... It's fun to see, like... I've thought about one of the superhero wallets or whatever, where they make them out of the old comics, you know, and have those designs on them. But it just, but having all that, plus with Hollywood, we have enough of the Autograph Alley, the pay ones. There's always a big voiceover contingency. I always joke with my friends that I'm going to, you know, in 20 years claim I did the voice to some cartoon and see, because who, especially before the internet, like who knew what, I never knew what those people would look like that voiced the cartoons I used to watch.
They look like you.
The hero that could be you. So yeah, and they have all the, like the different Power Rangers, and I'm like, that's another one. Like you could just say you were one of the recruit, you know, fill in Power Rangers at some point.
I was the beige anyone really Power know? Ranger.
Yeah, I don't know, Andrew, maybe you voiced Panthro at some point from Thundercats. Yeah. Like, who knows?
What about one of the villains from Power Rangers, like, yeah. in the suits? Like, I was the guy with the, you know, tusks coming out of his head.
And I like how they come in waves. Like, at Long Beach, I saw the guy that played Flash Gordon from the movie, and he was at Kamikaze as well. Nice. I'm like, that's nice. So it's fun to see him out. And then they always also do a big... Their big get probably in the autograph world is the Batman 66. So at one point, Julie Newmar steam passed on her little rascal and had someone clearing the way in front of her and everything. But it just amazes me that, like I always joked about Lou Ferrigno, it seemed like by this point you'd think everyone that wanted Adam West's signature would have had it, but he had a line. Like before he got there, people were lined up when I was walking by, and I'm like, he still got what people want.
Unless they, you know, he does the whole talking thing where you can go up and, like, I don't know. Sometimes you see some of those signing things where they're just, like, signing and you move on type of thing. You don't have that much interaction.
I think that's most of them nowadays. They've got the limited I know about that world, or at least the photograph element. They've got that down to, like, you know, 5 seconds per photo or whatever, so they can do 1,000 an hour, or however many they get through. You know, that's a lot of people make a lot of money on that. Oh, so
yeah, have you seen some of the like articles out there about like how much like
bags full of cash?
Yeah, like the cast of Arrow or whatever. Like they can make like ridiculous money.
Yeah, it's fun. Well, many years ago at a C2E2, friend of the show Andrew Shaw. And Dan Pua had purchased one of the character actors from there. I don't know the show, but because I was waiting in line with them and you're allowed a certain number of people, they let me crash the photo. So it was fun having us. But that's where I really got an appreciation for how they have that down. Like next, like they're processing one person's stuff and getting them out. And then they have the photos right at the end. Like by the time you get to the end of the line, the photos are ready and everything. I was just impressed at how They're mean in business, but probably the most interesting thing I saw was Torpedo Comics, which always had these racks of cheap books. Not really cheap, but cheap enough. You know, like 50% off or 40% off or something, which is a decent deal, but not like the mega deal. But they had a high-end section of slab books and other, just high-end. And First Appearance of Electro, ASM 9. I saw a 9.8.
Wow.
And I had no idea that that was even possible. I'm with you. I'm like, I didn't know comics that old were that good. And then I was talking to the guy, and he's like, yeah, $65,000 for that.
Holy
And I'm
geez.
Like, no way. I wonder if I'd offered him 30 grand in cash if he'd take it. But
exactly.
Still.
Would you take 64?
I wonder if you got the comics like pressed, or like if it was like there was damage or something, and then he pressed it and then like increased the rating. Because I don't know if you've seen like between like a 9.6 and a 9.8, sometimes the price goes up. Like just it's insane.
Oh, that I mean, I had guessed that was like a $7,000 to $10,000 book, but then again, I'd never seen 9.8. You know, I have a bunch of those Ditko ASMs. It's the one slabs I collect that are worth something.
Wow.
But my highest is probably like a 6 or something, and it's still very reasonable. But like it's not it's an exponential curve with those.
Yeah.
Like the high end grades are just not. It's thousands at like every point is thousands of dollars at least. Well, so it is crazy.
Maybe you can get some 0.5s of some of those like early issues.
Well, I have a few. Actually, I have a few, but none of the early's. They're still Ditko. Yeah, those first 10 are just. Yeah. Even 0.5s are past my league. Unlike Super Steve.
I have a 0.5 of one of the early issues.
Yeah, that's real money. That's more than that. Oh, yeah. But that part was just fun seeing the, like that. And that it wasn't like a special. It was just in a row of books. It wasn't especially pulled out or anything. It was just in the row of their high-end books along. They had two walls of them. And I was like, wow, man. That's a pretty cool thing just to see. But that's what I mean about there were some comics there. But when you split up the floor and they only have one floor this year, plus you put the main stage there on the floor, which I really like because you can just kind of breeze in and breeze out. But it means that you're not going to have a lot of any one thing. So as a generalist show, out of it was 2.5 days, Friday evening, Saturday and Sunday. I only went Friday evening and then Saturday. And the programming... mentioned this on Marvel Noise. It's a lot of like how to get into cosplay and, you know, which thing do you like better, kind of fan panels and stuff, which is fun, but nothing I feel like taking time off of from the floor or hanging out with my friends or whatever. So that was the other thing. Maybe if there'd been some must-see panel. Sort of tempted for the Wonder Woman 75th panel. That was the only one. But that was when we were having lunch with friends. And that's what cons are a lot, is seeing a lot of people. That's the part I really like. It's like, oh, it's our chance to hang out with Parks and Cons. They're on Twitter and have a podcast and a YouTube channel and all that. I've talked about them before. So we were having lunch with them. And it's just, it's just really crazy how popular the show is become. And I think that generalist approach is why. But, oof, it's a lot of people. And the LA Convention Center is not the nicest convention center in the world. But I'd still say if you're in the area... don't mind go. Give it a shot. I mean, I don't mind because I don't care about Halloween. So, like, losing Halloween is no big deal at all to me. I don't know if you guys are big Halloween guys. You guys like Halloween?
Oh, Halloween's yeah. Fine.
Second to Christmas.
Oh.
Wow.
So, yeah. Yeah, Steve's in it. I mean, I don't hate, but I don't dress up or anything. Like, that's just not my
thing. I got kids, so they have the whole dress-up thing, and I love reading horror stuff and seeing scary movies and all that. Halloween's fun.
I'm putting Thanksgiving ahead of Halloween, that's for sure.
Come on, slutty witches.
I feel like, at least
here...
Who doesn't
like slutty witches?
It's become a very big, like, industry, and there are, like, people turn their houses into, like, commercial haunted houses and stuff. Oh, it's weird. It's, yeah. They go and also feel like, I mean, I'm past the age where I have to go to parties or whatever, but I always resented having to throw together some kind of costume or whatever to go to someone's Halloween party. I'm like, that's not my...
You mean...
I just go as me.
They told you to be Doctor Strange or something, or like Mr. A, and you'd be like, I'm not doing that to come to your party.
Yeah, but I don't have any of that. Like, I'm not the guy that's going to go... buy all that stuff or sew it or... And besides, people... I don't know where you guys are at, but here, Halloween, people have raised their game crazy. Like, the outfits they wear are, like, almost screen-ready and everything. It's like the cosplay, you know what I mean? People take that stuff... It's not just buying some junk from the store and throwing it on, you know what I mean?
It's not the old Ben Cooper costume in the cake box.
Yeah, I loved... Oh, I love those plastic masks with the ridiculous smocks.
And with the hole, with the slit of the plastic for you to breathe through, but you'd stick your tongue through it and you'd cut your tongue.
And, you couldn't really breathe, and I wore glasses, so they didn't work well at all.
Oh, like, man, it would get all...
train wreck.
It would get all humid in there, and it would fog up your glasses. But... you with that vinyl plastic smock you'd put on, gosh darn it, and the mask with the, you know, elastic band to hook on, you could if you shopped around, you could find like any character from like any show or movie or comic book. Or boy, it was just like, no, let's go to the other pharmacy and see what they got. And it would just be just shelves and shelves of those Ben Cooper boxes with here's Scooby, here's, and then the Star Wars ones hit, and oh man.
Those were the ones for me. I didn't want any of the nice outfits that people made at home. No, I don't want that quality stuff. I want the cheap piece of plastic.
Yeah. Till you're a teenager and then you start going as a hobo every year.
I had a ridiculous pirate outfit that was just like a blousey shirt and boots and like a whip. I could put a bandana up, my hair back, and then I'm like, I'm a pirate. And that lasted me for 10 years. Pirate.
No, the best is when you go as your own characters. You're like, I'm my own comic character from my own comics.
Some people get stuck up in that, and like the people who are answering the door, they get stuck with that whole like IP advertising element, and it's like, who are you supposed to be? It's like, kid in a costume, what the heck? What does it matter to you? Like,
just give me my candy.
Who are you supposed to be? Isn't that the point? Like,
but yeah, well, what I don't like is I can't collect candy anymore. Sure, kids can, but what about me?
My kids don't finish the candy, so I have no problem dipping into their reserves.
Luckily, someone at work brought a bunch and just dumped it in the break room, and I'm like, woohoo, fun size Snickers, here I come. But I probably don't need Halloween candy. But so all my books today are going to be that I picked up at Kamikaze, although I've gotten better. I'm buying way less rando books than I mean, I still buy a bunch, but I'm not buying like I used to. Because it just got to the point that it was silly. I mean, no one needs that many random books, but I talked about this creator and series before, and in the interest of disclosure, I know this the writer somewhat well. I mean, we chat at conventions, and we've had meals outside of conventions. I wouldn't say we're, you know, secret lovers or anything like that, but we're, you know, we get along well, and I consider him a good person, probably. I'm trying to find the way to thread the needle where I'm admitting that this is somewhat biased, but I also don't want to paint it like, you know, I was godfather to his kids or anything. I mean, I like Alex, but he's a good egg, and I enjoy seeing him at the shows and having dinner, you know, the whole group dinner thing. But in the interest, he released his first full-size book from the Zayra series. You may remember I talked about it before. That was the one we looked at on Tumblr. I mean, I had the little ashcan version.
Yeah, that was good.
So the team, Alex Chung, the writer, who I know is out here, Dana Obera and Frank Cvetkovic. Should probably figure out how to pronounce that, but that's a lot of consonants close together. It was the letter. They did their first full-size book, Zyra and the Kronos Gem. So it's the same return of the same character, and this time she's on an adventure. And what I one thing I got to give a shout out, and Alex was quite proud of this, is the printing and the paper, and like it's a really nice. You know, I have lots of books with that Kablam printing, which is a fine company, but you know what I mean. It's nice when you get something a little bit higher end that's like could have come from any of the regular companies, you know.
It's like and a thicker really, stock?
Yeah, it's a thicker stock. It's also just like the print quality is super nice, and everything is just really, like there's a heft to it that you don't find necessarily in some of the other more regular. Like I said, the next book's going to be one of the Kablam ones, which is fine. Like, it's not like there's printing errors or anything. It's just when you push it up to that next level, I'm like always impressed with that, and it helps give it heft and no more. Like, this could have easily come out from any of the other ones, IDW or any of those other ones. But this is also on Comixology, if you're interested. It's our character, Zayra. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this right, but it's Z-A-Y-R-A. And in this instance, she has to team up and find one of her old friends who is messing with the time stream and has this time element. And the whole thing is really a an attempt to go back and change something in her life that has to do with Zayra. So it's a fun kind of story about using the magic to kind of heal their friendship. And it's a really great one and done. I don't want to give too much of the detail away as far as the mechanics of it, because that's kind of the fun and the storytelling. But if you like the first one, the art is of that same high quality. Storytelling is super solid. There's never a moment when I'm, you know, lost a little bit. I know some of these indie books can sometimes be a little, a panel here or there. You might find yourself having some confusion. But this was totally straight up good, because it opens with an action sequence. And the story does. And the magic is fun, too, because at one point, the magic creation parts form the panel barriers in a way, and that's kind of always nice when they can incorporate story elements into the panel and story design. Yeah, so give that out. You can check out Alex's Tumblr, Alex H. Chung on Tumblr, and that'll have that first short story we talked about. And like I said, if you like that, you'd totally like this book. It's on Comixology. I got a copy from him for $5, so I'm sure there are ways to get print copies elsewhere, but big thumbs up for me.
Cool.
Kevin or Super Steve? I don't know who's next up on the chart.
I'll jump in. I read a trade paperback that I hadn't heard of the series when it was either in single issues or digitally, however it came out at first. But this is from Legendary Comics, which has... isn't that the outfit that has Bob Schreck as the chief officer or the creative person or the head editor or something along those lines? But this is from Mark Wade and Ed Benes, and that's pretty much why I picked the book up. I'm thinking, gosh, Ed Benes and Mark Wade, that's going to at least be a pretty looking book and, you know, a story well told. The Rise and Fall of Axiom.
Hmm.
And it is a pretty pretty cliched type setup, but again, told by Mark Wade, so it's going to have its nice nuances and its own unique aspects of how the story is told. And it's going to be a pretty looking book because it's Benes art. And what we have here is like a Superman type coming to Earth with his mate, female mate. And they are like Superman and Superwoman. They're flying around and helping humanity, and humanity's loving them. And they're the, apple of humanity's eye. And one of the first things they did was help cure cancer. They wish that they could help with some of the other diseases, but that's the only one they kind of know the secret to. And things are going along well for them until the behavior of the humans starts to be riskier and riskier and with less thought of the consequences on a big scale, because Superman, this Axiom character and his wife, they usually pull humanity out of the, you know, out of the jam. So you've got like weird experimental projects going on that go awry, and the fear of something going wrong is diminished because of the fact that there are these super people around who, and the two of them, they can even be two places at once, you know, and something goes wrong with one of these experiments and the female part of the duo is lost forever. This leaves the Superman type shocked at first, but he's a good fellow. He forgives the humans. It was an accident. It wasn't meant to be. But he is suffering, and he's getting lonelier and lonelier and somewhat more detached from humanity. But he meets a girl in a weak moment and slowly becomes enamored with her, and they have a romantic relationship. At the same time, because of that, this girl has a target on her, because she's the lowest to this Superman, basically. And he can't be two places at once anymore like he used to be when he had his mate. And so the government has assigned like a G-man to kind of follow her around and protect her and whatnot, with the other task of keeping an eye on Axiom. And this G-Man has a brother who is like the first person who Axiom saved coming to Earth and became his biggest fan and like knows everything about him. Slowly things go worse and worse as we've seen, you know, in the deconstruction of the Superman, you know, motif. The guy starts getting harder and harder and more violent, and the government starts having to figure out how they're going to have to keep him in check and whatnot. And the fellow who is his biggest fan becomes the one who has all the inside information on him. And it really comes to a point where the guy totally flips and just starts killing a couple of people, high profile people. And he's got to be put down and dealt with, or somehow gotten to leave. And even though there's lots of violence along the way, there's a lot of philosophical discussion between him and some of the humans who he's encountering. He's not just quick to, you know, I-beam everybody into ashes, but he's willing to hear people out. And so people kind of have a chance to, you kind of see this fractured psyche and him trying to wrap his head around his own condition and the human condition. And it's a very well told, it probably was 5 issues, maybe 4 issues to begin with. But again, the art is real pretty. There's not a lot of cheesecakey, pinup-y stuff. It's not, although the girls are beautiful throughout, but the faces are just told, are just portrayed so nicely. Benez does such a nice job on both male and female eyes and really portray a lot of expression through them, or convey, I should say. It was a good story. It was fun to sit down. I think I read it in maybe 2 sittings and just plopped through it, and it was a fun little ride. Just what I would expect from Wade.
Yeah, they're 2 great creators. I mean, you can't go wrong with that kind of pedigree. You know, it's always going to be fun.
Yeah, one of those things I just saw in preview. I saw the cover. I saw the creators. I'm like, yeah, I'll check that out.
I don't remember seeing that in previews. He certainly likes to write the Superman types because he had Irredeemable and all that going on before.
Yeah, I'm wondering if this is one of his Thrill Bent books or something that he's publishing in print through Legendary or something along those lines. Definitely worth checking out. You're up, Kevin.
I got a ROM-like comic.
You do? ROM-like?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if you checked out the link I sent you. But this is Power Button by Zack Soto. It's about the size of a digest, like with heavy stock covers. But the inside is sort of like more like construction paper.
Huh.
And I think this is just issue 0. And there's sort of like a next Earth type of thing, but I don't know if it's gonna be like the same story, or if like they could certainly do more stories off of this. But it has a basic, you know, ROM type of thing where there's a love story, there's a big threat to this planet, and then someone sort of has to like sacrifice themselves to become like something else so they can save their world. But they don't realize like what exactly when they've given up to, you know, do this. But it's really bright too. Like there's sort of like purples, blues, greens. Those are basically the colors throughout.
Yeah, it has a good presentation in that respect.
So I've read some of the other work by the creator. So I'm like, yeah, I think I'll pick this up. And it was fairly entertaining. So. Wherever this picks up with the next issue, like I don't know if they're gonna cover other ROM like characters or whatever, but I definitely want to check out more of whatever this is. Good sci-fi cosmic type of thing.
Cool. Andrew,
cosmic is always cool. My next book, this one's gonna be tricky too. A New Nana Key, number 1. From Thunder Frog Studios.
Thunder Frog.
They have a title, I guess, Thunder Frog. So this is the one. And this is Harrison Wood with a co-writer. He does the story art. Co-writer Woody Arnold. Colors Don Edwards. Letters David Herbert. And I was just walking through Artist Alley, and I'm like, oh, you know, I got to pick up some rando books. That's how I roll. So this is one that grabbed my eye. I saw the creators there, and I picked it up. And I'm like, well, let's try. I'm not going to get the full trade. You know, we'll just pick an issue. And issue one usually seems to be the smart one to start with. So I'm like, we'll try this issue one, and then we'll see, you know, how it goes from there. So, yeah, because on the back inside cover, there is a Thunder Frog title that is their regular one. That looks like it's a frog with a hammer. Basically, maybe not so unreminiscent of another one, but famous version, but more a little more cartoony. And this one is it's one of the Ancient Aliens type stories. So we're set in 1817 BC, and this regular jobbing guy is on his way, and like a spaceship type thing comes, and these robots come and ask him, and they take him to this god. And the god is really an alien. I guess sort of Rom-like, because he talks about his ancient civilization from another world. We're going to have everything be Rom-like.
Yeah, that's a good conceptual continuity here.
But it turns out that this guy's part of the ruling elite. And the problem is kind of the federation of planets is sort of log-jammed. And there's a resource issue. But you're not allowed to explore outside your territory because, you know, there's different factions. So the one sort of storytelling confuses, I'm not sure, I assume it's the young man that's sent, because I think it's his uncle telling the story about his uncle. So I think it's him that's sent on this mission. So he's like, okay, I have this secret mission. We found this other planet, but it's not in one of the worlds we're supposed to go to. So he sends him off, and when he lands there, he ends up finding his uncle on that planet, his other uncle. But they have to be careful. You know, they can't. They want to mine this planet, but they can't be too risky because they can get in trouble with the other planets around. I found the story pretty compelling, but the problem I would say is that it feels very setup-y. Like, that's the entire issue. And now there's a fair amount there, but I feel like maybe you need to break that story up, and it's literally the guy just telling the story to the other guy, which, you know, is... A lot of comics are like that, but I felt like they needed more, a way to sort of break the exposition up a little bit more. And on the double page with insert panels of like, it was a challenge to the king and they have to fight in combat type of thing. But, you know, accepting those two pages, this really is just that story of kind of the sci-fi element or whatever. And I wonder if there would be a way to dribble that information into the rest of the story. You know what I mean? Find a way to split that, because like I said, I enjoyed it, but I just thought, if I'm this is the only issue I bought, so you're kind of leaving me without a real sense of where we're what the other issues are going to tell. Is it more going to be the story? Is it going to be more action? Is it going to be what's going to be in it? Not that comics require action, but generally being a visual storytelling, we want some kind of something or other. Or is that being unrealistic? I mean, I don't need a 22 page punch up. But I felt like some of these ideas, whatever the story arc is, sprinkle those ideas throughout the story arc to sort of push these things forward. Or maybe do the, I guess they didn't want to do the cheat I hate where they have a segment and flashback or something, but feel like it could have used something like that. Not that it was at all, you know, I enjoyed it and everything, but, you know, you look at the $4 for an issue and you're like, well, you gotta weigh it against that kind of, you know, if this is spread out over 5 or 6 issues or whatever, that's a decent chunk of change. But like I said, the premise is interesting and I like the setup. I just wish maybe splitting the story a different way.
Fair enough. I read a couple of indie digital comics that I found on Comixology. Actually, one I found through Kickstarter, but now it's on Comixology, so I can finally share it with you all. The first one, though, isn't that one. It is from a comic company declaring itself Sex and Monsters Comics.
I hope it had those two things.
Monsters and girls. It is called Super Horror. And I just bought this basically because of what the cover composition and design was. It's set up to look like a 70s Marvel comic book with the banner across the top and a not approved by the Comics Code Authority and a corner symbol. And it has a giant monster smashing a building. And it says Gargantus Lives on the cover and says three illustrated shock stories. And across the banner, it's a sex and monsters comic. I'm like, well, this is going to be great. And what it is something very different than what I thought it might be based on the cover, but it was still quite enjoyable. What it is it is three wordless stories. One called Super General, one called Gullibani, and the last called Devil Girl, all in color, all drawn by the same artist, written and drawn by Celor, C-E-L-O-R, who is a Turkish illustrator. The first story is Super General, that shows a beautiful girl in her bikini swimming, and then she gets called in because Gargantus is rampaging through town, and she has to put Gargantus down in a kind of a violent way by flying through him and puncturing him, but not before she like hits him with a tank, swinging it around by its cannon and that kind of thing. The second story is Gullibani, which has a stripper type girl hero has to fight Gullibani, which is a Turkish supposed to be bearded like monster, but this guy doesn't have a beard, but he's got like spikes on his arms and stuff. She has to take him down, and she even does like a mystical move, and the way he shows the spell happening was pretty cool. And then the last story is Devil Girl. She is a vigilante dressed in a devil costume, and she breaks up a bank robbery, but then they get away and she has to chase them down in a car chase and then jump from the one car to the car that the assailants are in and take them down and everything. All action-packed, all very kinetic. Like I said, it's all wordless except for some sound effects. And I found it to be a refreshing, fun little indie comic. It turned out to be just what I was looking for, even though it wasn't exactly what I thought I was going to be getting.
Hey, you're going to like when the description either is a pleasant surprise or at least gives you what you need.
The second book was, like I said, was a Kickstarter from a writer-artist, illustrator named Joe Picar, whose pinup and cheesecake-type work I enjoy very much. His use of color, his digital painting style, it makes me think of, and I mean this in the best sense, it makes me think of Joe Chiodo's work from back in my old day of in the 80s and in early 90s. Where he just draws all these beautiful redheads, but with such color splashes, and the flesh is so warm because he uses so much color. And he has a couple of books that he's done that he has out on Comixology, but this latest one is called Red Velvet, and it's red with two D's and velvet with two T's. And it's a pirate story. And we have Red Velvet, who is a beautiful red-headed pirate captain, and her sapphic paramour, Lass, and they are just enjoying being, together on the high seas, and one of the guys on their crew organizes a mutiny, and the captain and Lass, after kicking him in the balls real good, are forced overboard and left to drown. And instead they are rescued in their moment of, during like a critical moment by Demona, the mistress of the sea. And they're not sure if it's just a dream when it all is done and said, but they wake up on a deserted island and have to make do. They have like a box of stuff has like some treasure and some pieces of equipment that they can use, but not much. And they have to set up shop and make their little island paradise, which is made a lot more lovely by the fact that the two of them are there together. And so they're running around scantily clad, if clad at all. And so now they have Red's Island with a population of two. And that's kind of where the first story ends, after kind of explaining how they got to the island. And the second issue, the Kickstarter just finished up. sorry, apologies to Joe Picar for not getting this episode out sooner to tell you about the Kickstarter, but that issue, that project just finished up, so that issue will come out soon, and that'll pop up on Comixology eventually as well. It's worth Googling or going to Comixology and checking out a little, some examples of Picar's work. Great, great stuff if you like pinup work. And the use of color. Color, color, color!
Hey, color is important, and with digital comics you can get, you don't have to worry about printing issues.
He does all his pencils work in red and blue pencil, and the effect that he gets, even from his like sharp, tight pencils, he gets these wonderful presentations of color just from the blue and red pencils. I mean, he's a real master of visual art. It's really fun to see his work. You know, he marches to the beat of his own drum, so we're left with... I also follow him on Patreon to be able to get to see other examples of his work and pinups and commissions and stuff along those lines. Really like his stuff. Not just a subject matter, but that's pretty good, too.
How come your thing isn't disappearing?
My thing is going to be here for a long time.
No, I was just wondering. You weren't talking, but your icon said you were talking.
Oh.
Like it was just a continuous stream of talking. I don't know, it's strange.
That's me usually.
I believe I mentioned Kill or Be Killed, like the first issue on here before.
Maybe. I can't remember. But I do know the series.
Yeah. Because I was kind of like, I don't know how to feel about this because it was...
Oh, yeah.
Because a guy was like going around murdering people and then you find out, well, maybe a demon is like whispering in his ear. Anyways, this is by Brubaker Phillips and Breitweiser.
I've heard of some of those.
Yeah. I think they're going places is what you would say, right, Andrew?
Yeah, those kids. They should stick with it.
I think I came to figuring out like that I was really liking the book and everything. Like it sort of clicked in place by the third issue, but I don't know if it's... Like, how I came to it, it's like, it's kind of weird. Because I'm like, maybe that's not really the takeaway. But I guess if that... It's one of those... You start getting real meta, and I'm like, well, maybe if that's what you took away from it, even if that's not what's intended, you're still enjoying the story. Like, what does it matter? And, you know, that... Because he's still going around killing people in between, like, having relationship issues and whatever. But I kind of look at it as like Khonshu from like Moon Knight is sort of like some kind of thing like that is sort of like whispering in his ear, telling him to do things.
Are you sure it's not more Rom-like in some aspect?
No, definitely not Rom. But it also I noticed something where. I'm sure this was probably be in, like, other titles that Brubaker has written. Or, I don't know, maybe it's an artistic thing. Sometimes it's really hard to tell, right?
Yeah.
Like if you're putting the text on the side of the page, and you have images on the right-hand side, and there's, like, no text on the right-hand side, like, is it the writer getting out of the way of the artist? Or, like, what is going on there? You know what I mean? So, it's kind of a turnoff initially because you just see a block of text all the way down the page. Like it's more like an illustrated novel type of thing.
Yep.
So then I'm like, oh, what am I getting into? And it's I guess it's fine if it's just someone's sort of like thoughts, but then it starts going into sequential storytelling over like two pages. So you're like at some point you're like, well, how am I supposed to read this?
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the. Mimicking, you know, a long text piece with a spot illustration in a comic. It's just...
Neither am I.
Like you
it
said...
It feels like they ran out of time.
It's disappointing. Yeah, what I do is I get sleepy and I start looking at the pictures and I skip all of that text and get to the next word balloon.
So I think... Like, thinking back on it, I was like, I think Remender did this sometimes on Deadly Class, but I don't think I really noticed. And I'm not sure if Brubaker has done this before, but it's like really obvious in Kill or Be Killed because there's just like pages and pages of it. But it's not just describing what's there. It's like thoughts and things he's going through, but like it's pretty clear what is going on, but I'm sort of like wait a sec, you know? Like it just really stood out to me. But it's not the whole comic. It's only like certain scenes and stuff like that. So I think that put me off at first, like getting right to the next issue right away, because I'm like, I don't know if I want to deal with that.
But you love these creators. Come on, you're going to give them a try.
So once I got into it, I got to admit, it was fascinating, good stuff and everything, but I don't really know what the story is about. Like, I thought I knew, like, you know, from the first issue, oh, this is going to be a certain type of thing, but, like, the relationship stuff and the places they go to in between his crazy killing is entertaining, even though I don't know, like, ultimately, is that all that we're going to do? Or, like, that's fine if that's all they do. Like, it's fascinating stuff. I just, you know, you kind of wonder, not what the end game is, but, like, are you going to find out? Like, is it just a thing about a guy's psychosis and dealing with hearing voices or whatever? Or are we going to go somewhere? Like, is he going to kill the president? Or, like, that's just a terrible example, but, you know. I don't really know where we're going, but I'm on for along for the ride right now, that's for sure.
You can kill the president of Canada, maybe. That'd be okay.
In some alternate reality where we would have a president, right?
I forgot that you people are self-evidently govern yourselves.
There should be some crazy indie comic where it's like, we gotta go get the president of Canada.
And they're still looking
ridiculous. Yeah.
It's at issue 35 now and they still haven't found him.
I don't know. I guess I like reading about these type of like messed up guys where he's just like, I gotta figure out how to find, like, I gotta get a gun and I gotta find someone bad to kill so I'm feeling better, but how am I gonna know if the guy's really that bad or something? Or it's like if he exhausts his list of people, like, oh, I know that guy who's a drug dealer in school or something, and then he runs out of people he's gonna kill, he's like, damn it, not gonna find someone else. Like, how am I gonna find, you know what I mean? It's just, I don't know. We'll see where it goes anyways.
Yes, please tell me. Andrew, want to do one more?
Sure, we can do one more round. I have another. I've done this before. I'm not a huge fan of it because I haven't finished the trade, but it was the last big thing I picked up there. It was a successful Kickstarter. That was for the first whole issue, 176 page volume one. And in fact, it's over now, but at the time they were just finishing their Kickstarter for the second volume. So that's always, I mean, it's not proof of anything, but it helps the pitch, I think, when you can say, look, you know, this was a successful, the first one was successful.
Sure.
So people must have been interested in seeing what it was. And what it was is the guy's a film creator. And part of the element of the film was it was about this comic book creator. And he creates this character. And then it goes on about the guy. But this guy decided that the character he created in the comic, in the movie, seemed like a pretty cool comic book character. So he created the comic book about it. And it's called Apama, APAMA, The Undiscovered Animal. I don't know. I should have looked and see if the second Kickstarter had made it. But I bought it from the guy there. And it's a Ted Sikora, Milo Miller, Benito Gallego. And part of the other style they do is they're like, this is total Bronze Age Marvel. And look like thought balloons and dense and the kind of storytelling. And as you guys know, I'm a that's enough to sell me in a heartbeat. The other thing that sold me is, like a lot of Kickstarters, they're smart to throw stuff in. So I was flipping through it to see, and the back is filled with all these pinups. And there's a Super Steve's neighbor, Fred Hembeck, did a pinup.
Nice.
And that also helped sell it. And Bob Burden from Flaming Carrot did a pinup. So there's all these fun kind of other people's takes on the character. And that was like, well, Fred Hembeck's on board. How bad? You know, it's got to be good. And that that era is perfect. And what it is he's an ice cream truck driver. So he's like again, very seven, you know, like your protagonist is just a regular working class slob. And the Apaima is this special creature from long lost to history. And he dreams while he's chasing this ghost and knocks his head and dreams of, it was a tournament of all the animals. And the animal that won at the end was this Apaima. And the prize they took was that they would exempt themselves from the animal kingdom. So no one would ever hear of them again, but they're the most savage beast ever. And so when he finds the ritual to evoke this creature, he gets those powers. So he's fast and savage and everything, but it takes him a long time to learn the ritual. So he spends like a month trying to figure, looking at the thing and taking pictures of himself to match it to the hieroglyphics and everything. And there's a scene where someone walks in on him and goes, man, you know, cause he's wearing like a loincloth doing this dance, but it works. And so he becomes the hero, and he's just, you know, regular Cleveland superhero fighting in the streets. But I love the art is very evocative of the Bronze Age too. Yes. And I just thought balloons and all that, but I really am enjoying the book.
Yeah. I just looked it up I just Googled it, and it's very indicative of, they're doing a great homage to John Buscema and Tom Palmer. I mean, they're really aping the style, the faces, everything. It's funny.
Yeah, so but my only hesitation is obviously I haven't finished it, so maybe by the end it's a horrible piece of nonsense. But that's something about a 70s book, is that they tend to be a little bit, not thicker, but, you know, there's a lot going on with the balloons and the dialogue and the sort of compressed action, so I didn't want to rush through it either. I'm enjoying, like, as I commented on Twitter, I've been reading Dracula, thanks to Steve and Jerry McDade's work on Marvel Noise. It's the same kind of thing, where you really want to take your time and not rush through it.
Looks pretty good. I've got one more digital book, another one that I just kind of happened upon on Comixology when I am scanning through the indie releases. Which, did you know the thing on Comixology that, like, if you do one of those indie, like, submit-type books, that you as a creator, you don't see a cent until after the 100th sale?
I did not know that.
That's pretty rough.
Is that for everyone?
That asks a lot of the, I don't know about for the publishers, but for the indie, like, you know, the individual submission folks, what used to be the Comixology submit, those indie books, the creators only start getting change after the first 100.
Weird.
Wow.
Maybe I shouldn't say that, but.
Yeah, yeah. Let's just leave it at that.
Okay.
It makes sense why they accept so many submissions, though. Because they have to know probably 99% of what they put on there, they'll never have to write a check for.
Yeah, they're making the first 100 or 200 bucks.
But
right?
Aren't you holding their money for like, or holding those records for like years and years and years?
Well, Comixology is making the money off it up front rather than taking their cut off the back end.
I guess it's just going to be a lot of inventory and record keeping in somewhere. Like instead of having like your warehouse full of books that aren't sale, you're just gonna have a logbook of how many sales someone has, right?
Yeah. But it's probably also on the creator to maintain whatever email, or because all it is going to be is whatever the contact they gave them, and if they don't update it.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure the language says that it's on you to, I mean, they have to tell them, but it's on them to maintain the contact as well.
Yeah, who knows if they'll have the same email or they'll even be alive or whatever.
And who knows how good the communication is. I mean, that used to be the thing about with the royalties of them saying that they're not selling as many books as they, you know, even for the big two, like saying they're not selling as many copies as they did to cut down on the royalty checks or whatever. It certainly seems like it's this dynamic that's ripe for abuse on the corporate end.
But, yeah, it just seemed like there's, like, I don't know if it's always been that way, but it seemed like there was people saying before, like, oh, that I'm only made a small amount of money on this. And then when you said that, I was thinking they sold 100 copies. Like, not in like a negative way, but, you know.
Yeah.
Things sell, or how many fans you have that pushes you over that amount. Maybe that's pretty much where you stop. Like, maybe you only have 100 fans. I don't know.
But in defense of Comixology, the cost to the creator is also zero. Like, they don't have to maintain a website or any of that. Like, it's whatever it costs to send it to them, and they still have print sales, other avenues. But yeah, that is it's interesting.
The book I found is from Space Goat Press, and it's not an Evil Dead related
book. So we have a Space Goat versus a frog.
Yes.
Yeah, with a hammer. Okay, I got this.
Let them fight it out for the right to be a Pama. This is a book called 40 Coffins, and it is a done in one, or it even has a cover stamp. It's one and done. We don't need number two. Their story's so good. So right away you're being told you're getting a good single story here, a complete story. And it is. It's 45 pages of story and like 50 pages overall because it's got some back matter. And like I said, it's called 40 Coffins from writer Rodolfo Santullo and artist Jock. It's not the Jock we're thinking of, though, who has done work for DC. It's Jock with a J-O-K, not C-K. But the art is really nice. It's like Kevin O'Neill.
So it doesn't look like Jock, though.
No.
It's
really Kevin O'Neill-ish, like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, linear, detailed, real nice work. It's a vampire story. It's a story of an 1800s sea vessel that comes ashore with a dead man tied to the wheel, and he's holding a crucifix in his hand, and the position of the knot for the ropes that are binding him to the wheel are show that he tied it and pulled the knot tight with his own teeth himself. So he tied himself, you know, the captain tied himself to his ship to bring this in, and died along the way. And they find his journal and some clues on the ship and try to piece together the story of what happened here. And it's a story of this vessel that's basically taken dirt from one place to another. A lot of dirt, boxes full of dirt. And they get boarded by another vessel who is going to check them out and see what they're carrying and if they're smugglers or anything. And it's like, no, got dirt. And you get to know some of the crew, the captain and first mate and other folks on the ship. And they realize that they're probably all going to be killed because they don't have anything but dirt. And they take the fight to the other vessel, and big gruesome fight, and they take them down and lose some men along the way. And on they go with their voyage, carrying the dirt. They start losing crewmen one by one each night. People start getting paranoid. What's going on? They search the vessel. There's nobody else on the vessel. They start pointing fingers at each other. It starts getting like John Carpenter, The Thing type stuff. Like, no, you're the one. No, you're the one. Well, you behave this way or you behave that way. You're the only one who is strong enough, that kind of thing. And what it is the dirt. It's the dirt from the vampire's castle and home that you need to set up your coffin to be able to be in a foreign land. So they've got a vampire on board and they can't find him because he'll turn into a bat or a dog or something along those lines, and he's picking them off one by one, and they're finally coming to terms with what is on board, and the last guy trying to defend himself from the evil and then bringing that evil to shore via the boat. It had a very Alien, you know, like the first Alien movie type vibe. It's basically a haunted house story in a lot of ways. You're trapped on this vessel and, you know, there's something evil, something wicked on there with you that's going to be picking you off, and there's nowhere to run to. Cool story and well told and a nice fun done in one tale.
That's totally out of Dracula. When the boat arrives, the captain's dead and lashed to the wheel.
Yeah, yeah. 40 coffins. Pretty cool.
So I have some questions from loyal listeners, or listener, if you want to take them.
Sure.
I got one that says, what's your first true independent comic book, and what compelled you to read that book?
Ooh. Mine would be, would Heavy Metal magazine count? I found a nice stack of probably 6 or 7 of issues of the first 20 issues of Heavy Metal magazine on a pile of books and mail and magazines in my dad's study. And it was like, wow, Richard Corbin, Den, and boobies and science fiction and European art, and this is awesome.
Yeah, I'm trying to... Mine would have probably been maybe one of like those Elric adaptations from First, or something probably from First.
Huh.
Or maybe Eclipse. One of those, maybe like Airboy was another early one I got into. Eclipse had the Airboy license. But one of those two, although it came pretty quickly, because I also remember like the Turtles.
Well, that's some,
and there were spinoffs of those too.
Yeah.
Remember those martial arts guides that the Turtles had?
But I was wondering if some of those count, because mine, I guess, would be like a black and white Turtles, but is that really, like, at that point, I guess it was true independent, but a lot of these things I was buying, like either the Valiant Marvel or like the Bongo Simpsons or the Turtles, like they're all like sort of like media tie-ins.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, I mean, people had given me like Classics Illustrated and Casper and all that stuff. I'm going by what I bought.
I
took the question to be not like people, and some of those works, the Faustus Classics Illustrated was a pretty good book. I mean,
oh, sure.
You know, as a kid, it was creepy as heck.
I had tons of the Classic Illustrateds, but those were still corporate comics as far as it being like, I know what you mean, Kevin, as far as it being a little more in like an indie creator almost rather than, you know, like Harvey Comics. Those were corporate comics. Those weren't exactly indie creators. The same thing with the classics. You're lucky if you even had a credit as to who the artist was. You know, there were so many staff guys that it wasn't until years later that they went back and you kind of could find out who drew some of those things. I think when I went to my first LCS, which was Fanico, that would have been my first opportunity to really buy some indie comics. I'm trying to, like, from the quarter bins and stuff, I'm trying to think of what the first couple could have been. And I mean, like, even before that, like in 76 or 77, I bought, like, Captain Canuck.
Hmm.
When I was in the Canadian Rockies, you know, that's pretty indie from Richard Comley. Also the Fred Hembeck albums, the Fred Hembeck files that Fanico published. And Fanico also had a bunch of, in the quarter bins, they had a bunch of the failed, at that point they would have only been failed about 5 years or so, a bunch of the Atlas comics, not the old Marvel Atlas, but the Atlas that Goodman's son, you know, that they started, that other company with Brodsky and stuff. So like the Phoenix and some of those other books from Atlas.
This is kind of a slippery slope, but as I try, like, I was thinking about this and I'm like, I think I shook some more information loose that I had, you know, I thought I had forgotten about. Like, I remember at the newsstand, like, buying the first issue of, like, Brigade.
Wow.
So I'm thinking, like, when I was looking it up, I'm like, wasn't that Strike Force? And I'm like, no, that was Brigade. and I was like, but is that like a true type of thing? Like, I guess it's the Malibu Image. So then I started going down like the list of like all the indie books like I would have bought, or sort of indie, like I want like one issue of Tales of Witchblade, like a few issues of Crimson, Telos. Or, like, when Astounding Space Thrills, it was a webcomic, they had, like, a published comic. I, like, have an issue of that. But if we're going into, like, indie mini-comics land, it's not until, like, my first Toronto Comic-Con. Because, like, the Isotope comic shop from San Francisco, they had a forum. And they did, like, live streams and chats and everything where you can see, like, the artists, like, drawing in their store as... you know, you were on there and everything. Like, I don't know if they still do that, but like one of the guys that was interested in like the forum and everything, like he was going to be at a Toronto Comic Con, and I picked up his like mini comic through that type of thing. So I was thinking that would probably be the like the real like indie mini comic scene. Like that would have been my first there, and that it was probably something about baseball or something like that.
Yeah, well, I've been dominating the conversation, but I even thought of one other that might be the first, not counting the Heavy Metal magazine, but more along the lines of an indie comic at an LCS, is the Munch Gulacy Saber.
Mm.
That's pretty early on.
Yeah.
There were all kinds of weird, that boom in the... In the 80s had all kinds of companies that came and went so quick. I don't even remember some of them because I remember
just Pacific.
Bizarre Pacific, but also ones that literally just did black and white. Like those were still color. Yeah. Like there were all those the black and white boom that just these companies would come and go and you'd buy like two issues and that would be the extent of it. And I'm trying to remember when my brother, who was going to school in Syracuse, that might have been, he took me to an early shop. And that's where I learned about Fat Freddy's Cat.
Nice. Yeah, I was trying to think of when I was reading the Rip-Off Press books, but I was a little older. I was more like 15. Those are great.
But yeah, so there were all those kind of comics that, you know, you would come out and get a few books and that would be it. And then they'd disappear. You'd never hear them again.
I gave all of those companies a try. Like when Pacific started publishing comics, I bought them all to give them a shot. When Eclipse started publishing comics and not just the graphic novel-y stuff, I gave them all. First, I was there to give everything a try, see what it was great. It was just, here's another company, boom, 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 a bunch of issues. Give it a shot, see what's what. That's how I discovered John Sable and E-Man and all that stuff. Really fun time with all those companies having this new outlet of these direct market shops.
Yeah, I was pretty basic. I'm like, oh, this is a media. I didn't say this is a media time, but I'm like, oh, Turtles in a comic.
I've seen that on TV.
Yeah, exactly. Or, oh, I hear this Image Comics company is hot. Maybe I should buy one of these. And then, you know, maybe Brigade's going to be $1 million someday in the future. That rarely went into the decision. But if you're at a newsstand and there's not much out, you're like, I might as well buy this Brigade, number one. Or then, I like vampires. Crimson has vampires. Maybe this will be good.
Yeah, it was just fun. Like Steve says, there were these weird... Also, some of them were really... I'm trying to find the right word. Really inappropriate comics. So it felt like this is before the internet and everything. So if you wanted something really kind of filthy and transgressive or whatever, it was probably, and you're young, it was comic books is where you were going. I mean, there were other areas, like Steve mentioned, heavy metal. There were other less classy versions of that that would have humor or nudity or violence or some weird mix therein that I used to really enjoy kind of dabbling in, because you're like, yeah, look at this thing, man. This is wrong. This is all wrong. And, you know, you're sticking it to the man by buying their ridiculous comics. But yeah, and it's fun also then later on, because I remember I was going through a lot of my old books before I gave them away and found like all these weird. I remember I sent Bob Gar. Like, I found The Realm or something like that that Guy Davis had worked on back then, some weird D&D-style comic. It was like, hey, now he's famous, you know what I mean? And so it's cool when a lot of those guys started at weird companies and went on and moved on to other things.
Yeah, didn't Bendis do, like, this weird, like, a Star Trek Quark Ferengi comic or something?
Oh, yeah, it was Arrow/Caliber, because I found, it was The Realm, and so I found these issues from, like, the mid-80s, and I was like, whoa, He likes BPRD. That's Guy Davis. So I sent him a few of them. I only probably had three or four because the distribution was really like maybe you'd get the next. You'd usually get one or two, but the odds of getting like a regular run were pretty slim back in the day.
Good question.
Yes, good question. But I think that's, unless anyone has anything else, that's probably a good place to wrap it up.
Works for me. Yeah, let's do this again soon.
Yeah, thanks for everybody. Keep watching the skies and watching your podcast dials for the next Indie Comic Book Noise.
Later.
Wait, are you supposed to be putting that on this show?
Through long December nights, we talk in words of rain or snow, while you, through chattering teeth, reply and curse us as you go. Why not spare a thoughtless day for those who have no flame to warm their bones at Christmas time? Say Jack Frost and the Hooded Crow. Children's loved around the fire, no family left to know. So lend a warm and a helping hand. Say Jack Frost and the Hooded Crow. Clings, your fate is none too clear. The Lord may find you wanting, let your good fortune disappear. All homely comforts blown away, and all that's left to show is to share your joy at Christmas time with Jack Frost and the Hooded Crow. December nights, we talk in words of rain or snow, while you, through chattering teeth, reply and curse us as you go. Why not spare a thoughtless day for those who have no flame to warm their bones at Christmas time? Say Jack Frost and the Hooded Crow.